asks, exasperated.
No, says Jackie. Keep looking.
Maybe it's the smirk on her face that makes Henry reevaluate and glance to the Tesla logo on the car.
Right, he says. Duh.
Garrett laughs, and I can't help but grin.
Glad I could be tonight's entertainment, Henry says. It's just one of the many services I provide.
I notice that although Henry left the keys in the ignition, trusting us, they're now in Kelton's hands. He gives them back to Henry so he can start the car and move us to a vehicle that actually runs on gasoline. But there's an unspoken message there. I'm not sure whether it's about distrust on Kelton's part, or power, or both. We drive around the snarl of cars until we come across a gas-guzzling minivan. Jackie gets out to guide us in. This time, when Henry turns off the gas, he tries to take the keys, but Kelton hops out of the truck and blocks him from opening the driver's door wide enough for him to get out.
Keys, please, Kelton says.
Henry forces the door open anyway, but Kelton stands in his way. I find myself irritated by Kelton forcing a confrontation now, when all we're here to do is get gas.
What am I going to do? Henry asks. Drive off and head for the hills?
A, we don't have gas, and B, you're the only one who knows which hills to head for. But Kelton isn't up for negotiating.
Henry throws a quick glance in my direction and says, fine, then tosses the keys to me instead of handing them to Kelton.
Kelton bristles at having been blatantly slighted.
He looks to me like I'm going to give him the keys, but I'm not. Because he's the one being an ass right now. Instead, I slip them into my pocket. If Henry sees me as the voice of reason among us, so be it. If he trusts me, maybe that makes me trustworthy.
Mercifully, the little door over the gas cap is one that opens by hand, rather than having to be popped from inside the van.
Okay, what now? I ask Jackie.
But she defers to Kelton.
I don't know. Can't you MacGyver something?
He shrugs.
You're the criminal mind, Kelton says.
What's a MacGyver? Asks Garrett.
Jackie sighs. An 80s TV guy with a mullet who could make cool crap out of nothing.
But none of us have either the mullet or the know-how to do this. All we have is a hookah hose. I realize that we are, all of us, out of our element. Even Jackie.
For all of her street smarts, siphoning gas is something she's clearly never done, and for all of Kelton's survival skills, he's useless in this particular pinch.
All I know, I say, is that you stick the hose into a gas tank and you suck on it.
This is truly the blind leading the blind. After four failed attempts and a mouth full of gasoline, Jackie throws the hose to the ground, uncrowning herself the queen of thievery.
I idly wonder if she had an urge to swallow the gasoline she got in her mouth, and it reminds me of my own thirst, but I push it to a back burner.
Meanwhile, everyone has an opinion on why the siphon isn't working, but our knowledge of this lost art is limited to fifth grade science labs and movies. With everyone giving their 2 cents, I realize I haven't heard a peep from Garrett. In fact, I haven't seen him since our first siphoning attempts.
Garrett?
I yell. Crickets. Wind. Silence. I check the pickup. Around the pickup. I run back to the Tesla. Nothing.
Garrett?
Kelton shushes me, and I know why. The distressed voice of a girl is a bleeding wound in a sea of sharks. But I don't have time to formulate a better course of action here. I have to find my brother. Before I know it, my feet are churning, and I'm hurrying off, diving deep into the maze of cars. I'm weaving in and out, screaming his name, but in a whisper, which is as useless as it sounds. My head is spinning. The freeways are death traps. I know. Kelton's pounded it into our heads. And even if I'm not alone, if someone has Garrett right now,
His well-being takes priority, and I must be fearless. Then I see smoke swirling in the air up ahead. A fire. It's somewhere farther down the highway. I know there have been brush fires everywhere, but on the freeway? I push forward, climbing, sliding over cars. I trip and fall, but I won't let it slow me down. And now I have a better view. It's a campfire in a trash can, and around it, at least a dozen people. And they have Garrett. When Garrett was 5, he wandered off the safari jeep tour at the zoo. I had to rescue him from getting kicked in the head by a giraffe. When he was 6, he almost went home with another family at the mall because their kids had cooler toys. When he was 9, he wandered off at the IKEA showroom and decided to nap in a race car bed in an attempt to become a permanent resident of the store. And I had to track him down before Mom and Dad found out and called in the National Guard. Disappearing is what Garrett does. He always does it at the worst possible moment, and for some reason, I always feel responsible. But this time, I'm more frightened than furious, because I've seen the monsters out there, and I suspect I'm going to see worse ones before this whole thing is over. He stands in the middle of strangers who could be as hostile as the marauders that raided Kelton's house. I scan their faces, trying to get a read on the situation. People of all ages. Then Garrett sees me, and he smiles. There she is! That's my sister! My heart is still tolling out danger. My head throbs, and I feel woozy from exerting myself. It's the lack of fluids. I approach cautiously. Then a woman steps forward. Silver, wavy hair, a soft complexion. Her eyes seem to glow, but it's only the reflection of the fire. Welcome, she says. Garrett, let's go, I order him. It's okay, he says, walking over. I went looking for a bucket, you know, to drain the gas into, but I got lost. They found me. I let my guard down a little. You must be Alyssa, the older woman says warmly. Who are you? I ask, still on edge. A little girl holding folded linen stops in passing. We call her the Water Angel. The older woman smiles kindly. Oh, stop it. The name's Charity, which is a much more charitable name than I deserve. But there it is. Now having calmed down a bit, I get a better look at her. She's as old as my grandma, maybe 70, though there's something youthful about her too. The way she holds herself, her sharp, radiant gaze. Jackie, Kelton, and Henry catch up, but keep their distance, still reading the situation. You could say we've taken up residence here, Charity says, addressing us all. At least for the time being. I look around and notice that there isn't just one campfire, but several, constellated across the span of the traffic-jammed freeway in different clearings. This is nothing like the homeless encampment we saw before. These seem like people from many walks of life who have decided that staying here in the midst of the crisis is better than being anywhere else. Kelton shakes his head. But you're totally exposed out here. Isn't it dangerous? At times, says Charity, but we found a way to keep everyone safe and hydrated. That last word pulls us all in. Jackie takes a step forward. You have water? There's water everywhere, Charity says with a faint grin. You just have to look in the right places. She examines our dirty clothing and probably reads how exhausted we are, both emotionally and physically. Why don't you stay with us? She asks, and when we hesitate, she says, Your brother seems to like it. This place feels okay, Garrett says. Safe-ish. And although safe-ish is probably the best we're going to get, Kelton is skeptical. We have somewhere we have to be, he says.
Well, at least stay the night. It's getting late. You can set out in the morning.
Then she returns to the campfire, leaving us to talk.
Henry opens the discussion. I say we stay. Rest, hydrate.
We have your entire box of agua viva in the truck, I point out, and realize to my horror that we have left it in the truck bed unattended.
Why don't we lock the water in the truck, accept their hospitality, and maybe even have these people help us siphon gas? Then we can leave.
And go where? Henry argues. Back to those nasty-ass aqueducts just to get lost again?
We weren't lost anymore, Kelton tells him. And there's not that much farther to go.
And then Jackie tips the balance. The aqueducts will be easier to navigate during the day, right? So let's accept the Water Angel's invitation and spend the night. It's not like we have to join their little cult.
Everyone agrees it's the best solution, even Kelton, as reluctant as he is to trust anyone or anything. I leave them to go find Charity. She's tending to a boiling pot. She's boiling water to purify it.
Okay, we'll stay the night, I tell her. But do you think there's anyone here who can help us siphon gas?
Of course, Charity says with a wink.
How do you think we get these fires started?
And maybe some of that water when it cools, Jackie says, coming up beside me.
But instead of responding, Charity steps forward and closely examines Jackie's face. Then she takes Jackie's hand and pinches it with her thumb and forefinger.
Ow! What the hell was that for?
I'm sorry, but I can't give you water now, Charity says. Your skin is still elastic, which means your dehydration isn't critical yet.
She's right, Kelton says, and Jackie sneers at him, whispering, traitor, beneath her breath.
Charity looks to Garrett, who's still sitting with another kid he found, then to the rest of us. I know how difficult it is to be thirsty, but I can't give you water in good conscience when there are others here who need it more. We can feed you, though.
Food! I forgot about food! And now I can feel my stomach roiling, eating at itself. I'm hungry, but even if I'm given something to eat, it would be hard to chew, because my mouth is dry and raw. Even swallowing water right now would hurt like needles. And then there's the growing pressure in my head. If I'm not worthy of water in this state, then I can hardly even imagine what it's like to be worse off.
We'll help you with your car trouble, give you shelter and something to eat, the Water Angel says. That will have to do for now.
Then she turns to a few rugged-looking men playing cards around the campfire.
Max, do you think you could help them out? They need gasoline.
Sure.
One of them stands. He's large and hulking, clad in leather like the leader of a biker gang. At first, I'm apprehensive, but as I've come to learn, looks can be deceiving, because at the end of the day, no matter what the person's exterior, there's only one thing that defines behavior, and that's water. In my other life, I might not have trusted this guy, but here and now, I do. Because I know he's not a water zombie. He hasn't turned yet. I suddenly feel guilty for doubting their intentions. In return, however, I will ask you to contribute to our little effort, Charity says. We'll be collecting supplies from the northbound lanes pretty soon. While Max here is fixing your car issues, perhaps a few of you could join us.
I'll go, Henry says, stepping forward.
Garrett looks to him and follows his lead.
Me too, he says quickly.
My gut reaction is to volunteer just so I can look after Garrett, to make sure that he doesn't wander off again or get into any trouble. But I stop myself. Lately, Garrett hasn't gotten us into trouble at all. Maybe I owe him a little more space, a little more trust. And if he's trying to contribute to something larger than himself,
Shouldn't I allow him that dignity? So I let my sisterly guard down, tell Garrett to mind Charity, and I joined Jackie, Kelton, and the jolly, gargantuan biker to fill up the truck. We follow Max to a small white landscaping truck where he pulls out an empty red plastic gas can and a gardening hose, the kind we couldn't find when we were looking before.
It's really hard to siphon directly from one gas tank into another. You need a gas can like this so you can position the hose lower at this end. You know, gravity.
Gravity, Kelton mutters, clearly annoyed that he couldn't figure that out himself. Garrett had figured that out instinctively because he had gone looking for a bucket. We've all had an opportunity to feel stupid today. We zigzag back toward the truck. My body has grown heavy, which makes each step weightier than the previous one, and it seems our exhaustion is a little more obvious than I'd like to believe, because Max takes notice.
Here.
He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a little plastic-wrapped pastry.
It's a moon pie. Currently our staple food.
Thanks, Jackie says, opening the wrapper and biting into the chocolate marshmallow spongy thing. She chews on it dryly, realizes there's only one, and reluctantly breaks the rest of it in half for me and Kelton to share.
Bon appetit. We found a whole truck of them 2 days ago, he says, then adds, A few years back, I remember hearing about a stranded cruise ship. They airdropped them Spam and Pop-Tarts. I don't know about you, but I'd rather have moon pies.
Is that how long you've been here? I ask. 2 days?
Three, he says. I wandered onto the freeway 2 days after the tap out. I had it worse than most people on account my blood pressure meds make me sweat like a racehorse. Dehydrated real quick, and I couldn't get a drop of water for the life of me. I wandered onto the freeway determined to either find water or drop. I dropped, but the water angel found me. Charity gave me water. And when I was strong enough, put me to work. Before long, there were dozens of us, all working and taking care of each other.
Kind of like a commune, Kelton says.
Yeah, I guess it just kind of evolved into that. We all have our own skill sets. Turns out I'm pretty handy, he says with pride.
Well, you're a lifesaver, I tell him.
Thank you, but we have a medic for that.
He chuckles.
Others gather supplies. Just yesterday, they found a semi full of new linens and pillows.
Just the thought of it makes me long for my comfortable bed.
We have folks who keep a watch at the perimeter around the clock, Max continues. Those are the ones who found your brother.
We reach the truck, and luckily the Agua Viva box is still in the back. Max settles by a nearby Hyundai to siphon gas, and while I keep him occupied, Kelton and Jackie move the Agua Viva to the back seat of the truck, locking it in. Since it's not my water to give, I get around the crisis of conscience that would come from withholding the Agua Viva from the water angel. Still, I feel guilty about it. But I'll live with the guilt. If that makes me a bad person, I'll care on a different day. Jackie and Kelton probably feel the urge to rip the box open. I know I do. But as Charity said, we're thirsty, but not desperate. And Kelton has drilled into our heads that an emergency supply is for emergencies. Although, I can't help but sense that desperation is right around the bend.
28. Henry.
I have found that the elderly can be either deranged or sagacious. It's a complex equation made up of their life experiences, the advanced nature of their years, plain old genetics, and how pissed off life has left them. The water angel is of the sagacious variety, wise beyond her years, which says a lot, considering how old she is. She has figured out a simple, brilliant way to collect water. Water that's been right under everyone's noses all along, but is so far out of most people's boxes that they could die of thirst inches from the source and never consider it. washer fluid. Not the actual fluid, but the containers that hold it, which are in every car. Most of the time people fill them with that blue Windex-y stuff, which is positively toxic, but every once in a while people can't be bothered with the good stuff and use water instead. Who would have thought it would be that lazy substrata of society that would save us? Even if the water angel isn't willing to share with us, having the knowledge is enough. Teach a man to fish kind of thing. Of course, our truck doesn't have either water or washer fluid. It's completely empty, as I discovered when I tried to clean bugs off the windshield earlier. We're sent in teams of two to search cars on the northbound side of the freeway, maybe a quarter mile up, because all the closer cars have already been inspected. We're accompanied by a paunchy pair of 20-something identical twins, Tweedledum and Tweedledumber. There's a nagging mother and her seemingly mute child, and an older couple who have been married for so long they've morphed into near-identical androgynous versions of each other. Each team is given a backpack, a flashlight, a coat hanger, and a crowbar. Many of the cars are locked, which means the hoods are unable to be popped, so we use the coat hangers to try to pop the locks, and if all else fails, use the crowbar to smash a window. It's not like we're destroying property that matters anymore, Charity told us before we left. Chances are these cars will be bulldozed to clear the freeway when this is all over. Although we've been instructed to be on the lookout for items that may benefit the greater good of the collective, I've been more interested in a wider variety of things. See, in the heat of the moment, when people were escaping these freeways, something truly interesting happened. There was a cataclysmic shift in values, kind of like a market crash. External events combined with mob psychology and generated a positive feedback loop. Well, not positive for them. Their only goal was to survive, which meant people were quick to forget items of high value that didn't improve their immediate chances of said survival. Watches, jewelry, cash. You'd be amazed by the things that turn up in cup holders and glove compartments. Not that these things were left on purpose, but stuff simply got forgotten because they were no longer on the radar of critical possessions. Sure, most cars contain nothing but junk, but I managed to acquire a few unexpected assets that would otherwise go to waste. "Look what I found," says Garrett, looking in the rear window of a hatchback. Garrett indicates a bag of diapers in the back seat. "I remember there was a woman with a baby sitting back by the fire." "Good thinking," I tell him, because value comes in many forms. "She'll appreciate that." And, I realize, so will the rest of us. The door is, of course, locked, and multiple attempts to unlock it with the coat hanger are less effective here than elsewhere. "I guess we're just going to have to break the window," I say. To that, Garrett almost involuntarily gives a mischievous smile. That smile speaks volumes. It says he wants to break things, but never had permission. He wants to be wild, but has never been off the leash. I know that feeling, and I realize that I can save him years of future therapy by one simple action. I hand him the crowbar. "You do it," I say. He looks a little scared. "Are you sure?" I shrug. "Charity said we could if it was the only way in, right? Go on, give it a shot." Garrett hefts the crowbar, gives that involuntary smile again, and swings it at the window. It shatters with the first blow. Not an explosive sound. More like the popping of a light bulb, followed by the patter of safety glass pellets. I'm actually surprised by how much force he put behind it. I thought the first swing might be timid. "Well done," I tell him. "Try another." Without hesitation, he turns to the car behind us and swings again, smashing the closest window. "My turn," I tell him. I see a Mercedes with a hood ornament. The car looks like my asshole neighbor's, who sued us for building a retaining wall 2 inches onto his property. I take a swing at the ornament, fully prepared to see it fly off like a golf ball, but instead it gets knocked over and pops back up into place. Darn. I forgot that Mercedes ornaments do that, so they don't get ripped off in car washes. I take a second swing, and it pops up again, It makes Garrett laugh. It punked you, he says. Oh yeah? Take that! I smash off a side mirror. Suddenly, there's one of the Tweedles lumbering up to us. Hey, he yells. You're supposed to be looking for water. We couldn't get in, I inform him. Had to smash a window. He glances at the dangling side mirror. That's not a window. Guess I missed. Garrett snickers, and the Tweedle glares at me. Stay on task! Then he lumbers back to his brother, who has been gingerly trying to get into a Buick for 5 minutes. I turn to see Garrett grinning at me, and I realize he's looking at me in a way that he doesn't his sister. He's clearly never had an older brother figure in his life. It puts me in a unique position. I lean against the car and speak casually. Your sister would kill me right now if she saw what we were doing. Who cares? He reaches for the crowbar, but as a surrogate big brother, I hold it out of reach, indicating that's enough. For now. Funny how she treats you like you're just a kid, I tell him, even though you're the one with most of the good ideas. He looks to me, just a little bit wide-eyed. You think that? Are you kidding me? If it weren't for you, we wouldn't have found the aqueduct. And aren't you the one who found these good people? Thanks to you, we have a safe place to spend the night. Yeah, I guess so. We all have our skills. Yours is seeing things that the rest of us don't. It's true, and I can tell he appreciates that I've noticed what others overlook, just like him. It's a nice bonding moment, one that serves a purpose. So tell me, I put to him, what other things do you see that the others don't? He considers it, then says, well, I don't think Jackie is as horrible as Alyssa makes her out to be. Really? What makes you think that? Well, it's like the girls on her soccer team. Alyssa always trash-talks about the ones she kind of sees as a threat. I'll bet Jackie and my sister could be friends if they weren't both so set on hating each other. A sharp observation. Useful, too. If I can keep them turned against each other, they're not turned against me. Or at least Alyssa isn't. After nearly stranding Jackie at the evac center, I doubt I'll ever win her over, but I may not have to. How about Kelton? I ask him. He laughs. He's just glad to be in the same car with my sister. Kelton's had a serious crush on Alyssa since, like, forever. I feign shock. Get out of here! No, seriously. When they were in elementary school, he'd hit balls into our yard on purpose. And when they were in eighth grade, I caught him spying on her with one of his helicopter drone cameras. He paid me $10 not to tell her. Not quite the information I was fishing for, but when you catch a boot, you never know what else might be lurking inside. Spying how? I ask. And he sits on the big pack of diapers to spin me a nice little story. We return to camp to join the others about an hour later. And though Garrett and I didn't find any washer reservoirs that contained water, some of the others did. But we pulled our weight in other ways. We found some painkillers, a Bluetooth speaker fully charged, binoculars, and of course the diapers. Charity travels around, picking and choosing who is most in need of the water she has, while our little group is brought to 5 cars near the guarded perimeter, the back seats of which have been spread with linens. Someone has left a moon pie on each pillow. Real concierge service. There you go, Garrett, Melissa says. Didn't you always want a car bed? Garrett is not amused. Jackie looks at her moon pie. Banana flavored. How can we even digest these without water? She says. And how do I know I won't die of thirst in my sleep? You won't, Kelton says. You'd have to be a lot worse off. You'll feel more and more tired, but then, right before the end, you'll get a sudden burst of energy. It's the body's last stand. After that, it's all over. TMI, Kelton, she says, not wanting to think about it. TMI. We should all call it a night, but we're at that state where we're too exhausted to sleep, and none of us is looking forward to sleeping in this heat, which seems only a few degrees cooler than the day. I take my acquired letterman jacket off and set it on my lap, wishing that its manufacturers could have had the good sense to use a fabric that breathes. The five of us now hang out in a small clearing in between the cars to wind down. The trash can fires are out, and the moon paints everyone in blue shadows.
"I really don't get it," says Jackie. "How are these people not tearing each other apart, like in every other place we've been?"
"They created a system," Alyssa says. "Not everyone can do that." I feel a need to enlighten them. "Communism only works in theory, and goes against human nature. This place won't last."
"It doesn't have to," Alyssa points out. "Only until the crisis is over."
"They'll turn on each other," Jackie says. "Everyone does eventually." Alyssa throws her a glare.
"Everyone like you, maybe."
"Oh, are you going to tell me your neighbors weren't like these people? Fine, upstanding citizens until they started eating their young?"
I glance to Garrett, who just shakes his head knowingly at me.
Jackie and Alyssa will never agree on anything.
"People suck," Kelton says, adding his own two cents. "Always have, always will."
"I don't see it like that," Alyssa says. "People might do whatever they can to survive, but once they don't have to worry about that, they're different."
"Sometimes," Kelton argues. "Sometimes not. Some people are always like that and just pretend to be civil."
He says that looking at me. I'm not sure if that's intentional, but it still pisses me off. Jackie bounces her knees, amused.
"Oh, looks like we've got ourselves a classic Hobbes versus Rousseau philosophical quandary."
It catches me off guard to hear Jackie make such a reference, especially because I don't precisely know who Hobbes and Rousseau are, but not knowing and admitting you don't know are two completely different things.
"Yes, that's one way to see it," I tell them. "But I think you're both wrong. People are nouns, actions, and verbs. Apples and oranges."
"Ding, ding, ding, and we found our Machiavelli," Jackie announces, like a showman.
And then suddenly, as absurdly and unexpectedly as she pulled philosophers out of her ass, she pulls a gun out from God knows where. A gun. A real freaking gun. We all jump out of our skin, but maybe me more than the others. Did she have that all along? And now I'm thinking back to the dozens of times she could have shot me today, like when I pulled that airsoft gun on her. Not my best move.
"Damn it, put my gun away!" Kelton says, adding one more layer to this crazy cake.
Did he say his gun? She just ignores him, marveling at the weapon, turned on, invigorated.
"Tell me, Henry, if I put one of these bullets right into your head and got your brains all over Kelton and his moon pie, would I be a noun or a verb?"
"Jackie, put that away before anyone else sees it,"
Alyssa growls. But it only energizes Jackie. She will not be controlled. And now I get why Alyssa sees her as a threat. Because she is.
"Come on, Henry," Jackie taunts. "I thought you were the captain of the debate team. Or at least pretended to be."
Then she points the gun at me.
"Convince me that I am not my actions. That doing something bad doesn't make me bad."
I talk fast, trying to pretend I'm not a thumb pull away from oblivion. I don't know if that gun has a safety on it. Hell, I don't even really know what a safety is. You wouldn't be good or bad, right or wrong, because concepts are fluid and subjective, and it would flip depending on whether or not killing me was the right thing to do. But it's not. It most definitely is not. Jackie holds there. Everyone else is frozen. No one wants to jump in and maybe accidentally set the gun off. Finally, she withdraws her arm and tucks the gun away, suddenly disinterested.
"You're no fun," she says.
Jackie goes back to eating her pastry, speaking with a full mouth.
"You're a bunch of scaredy cats anyway. There was no bullet in the chamber," she says. "Or was there?"
A mental note. There are now two confirmed psychopaths in our party of five. Kelton and Jackie will have to be taken down if I am to assume my rightful place in charge and protect Alyssa and her brother.
29. Alyssa.
I lie in my makeshift bed, eyes peeled open. At least I think they are. I don't have the energy to sleep or to be awake. So I toss and turn, in and out of consciousness in a delirium of anxieties that haunt both states. Thoughts of Jackie, the gun, my parents, mixed with nightmares of marauders raiding the freeway like they raided Kelton's home, led by Hallie on my soccer team and her mother, who's now 15 feet tall and steals everyone's water. Then it starts to rain blood, and Kingston is there, lapping it all up. The rain resolves into a tapping noise. My eyes snap open. It's Henry, and he's standing just outside my car, tapping on the half-open window. It's still dark. I'm not sure whether it's somewhere around midnight or closer to dawn. "You were talking in your sleep," he says. "I could hear you from my car." "Oh, sorry." To be honest, I'm glad he woke me up, as tired as I am. I'll take him over the hallucinations, so I open the door and get out, stretching. "Have you noticed that it's snowing?"
"What?"
Sure enough, there are snowflakes settling gently around us. But it's got to be almost 90 degrees. Now I know the world has gone crazy.
"Don't catch them on your tongue, though," Henry says. "I don't think they'll taste very good."
I catch one with my hand and rub it between my fingers. It's ash.
"The brush fires have grown up," he tells me. "They're full-fledged forest fires now, pretty far east of us, but the Santa Ana winds are bringing the ash our way."
As I look around, the cars are beginning to grow a fine layer of gray dust. We lean against the side of my Cadillac, watching the snow settle. "It's so quiet now," I say. "It almost makes you forget what's out there."
"Nothing out there but people," Henry points out.
"People can be monsters. Whether it's just their actions or whether it's who they really are, it doesn't matter. The result is the same." Henry shrugs as if it doesn't bother him. I wonder if he's really so nonchalant about it, or if it's just an act for my sake.
"Sometimes you have to be the monster to survive," he says.
I shake my head at the thought, then grimace at the pain that comes with moving my head. "I could never be that kind of monster," I tell him, "no matter what." Rather than commenting on that, he lets another snowflake land on his palm, studying it for a few moments.
"I wanted to apologize," he finally says, "for not telling you the truth about not being the guy my jacket says I am. But with all that was happening, there didn't seem to be a right time."
No apology is complete without its but. Well, at least he's trying. So I decide to let him off the hook. I know it's stupid of me to trust him, but I decide to do it anyway. "I get it. Common courtesies have gone the way of running water," I tell him. "No one's acting the way they usually would." He smiles. "You're a very forgiving person." His smile seems genuine, and I look away from his gaze. I wonder if it's possible to see a blush in ashen moonlight. "Not really," I tell him. "I just don't hold grudges." Which isn't entirely true. I hold plenty of grudges, but right now it would be a waste of valuable energy. "But you are forgiving," he insists. "You let me come with you, even after acquiring your uncle's car, and it looks like you are beginning to forgive Jackie for, well, for just being Jackie. You even forgave Kelton after the whole drone thing."
I get caught on that last part.
"What?"
"You know, how he used to spy in your window with his drone."
But I don't know. I have no idea what he's talking about. My stomach begins to fill with a weird, greasy feeling. "Who told you that?"
"Garrett may have mentioned it in passing,
But don't get him in trouble. I only bring it up to add evidence to my argument about your forgiving nature. Then he grins. I did pretend to be captain of the debate team, you know. But right now, I don't feel forgiving at all. I feel stupid and embarrassed and violated. My face must be turning a much more visible shade of red now because Henry says, wait, you mean you didn't know? Why should I be the one who feels embarrassed? Kelton's the creep here. And before I know it, I'm abandoning Henry and I'm storming over to Kelton in his stupid little hatchback, pounding on the door, then kicking it until he pops his nasty little orange head up and opens the door. What? What is it? What's happening? Did it feel good, Kelton? I growl. Did it? Was it fun? Was it everything you thought it would be? I know, in the midst of everything going on, that this is not the highest priority right now, but it feels like it. It feels huge. What? What are you talking about? He stammers as he scrambles out to face me. Did you or did you not spy on me with your drone? He hesitates. That's all the answer I need. I push him back against the car. You lousy, stinking creep! Alyssa, it was in eighth grade. There is no statute of limitations on being a certified douche. And I only did it once. It doesn't matter how many times you did it. The fact is, you did it. Alyssa, don't you say my name, I yell at him. Don't you even think it, ever. I storm away from him because I know if I stay, I'm just going to keep on screaming and that will wake up half the people here and make them come running. And I don't want this to be any more of a federal case than it already is. There's a battle in my head now. Part of me wants to file this away and deal with it when we're not in a crisis. His brother is dead. There are more life and death challenges we have to face. Yet there's the other part of me that will not be silenced or ignored. The normal part, which won't let such an unacceptable act slide just because there are bigger things to worry about. No matter what else is going on, I have every right to what I'm feeling. I go back to my car. I'm thirsty, and I'm angry, and I think maybe I'd rather face the nightmares than this, after all. Henry appears at the window. Alyssa, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. Well, you did, I snap. Then I feel guilty about it, so I speak a little more gently. I know, I shouldn't blame the messenger, but it's hard not to. I understand. Then he puts his hand on the door handle. Can I come in? I actually consider it. But right now, I want to keep all of humanity at a 10-foot pole distance. I'll see you in the morning, I tell him. Okay, he says. Sleep well. But we both know there's zero chance of that.
Part 4. Bug Out. Day 6. Thursday, June 9th. 30. Kelton.
Alyssa isn't talking to me. Garrett won't look at me, and Jackie seems to find that amusing. Henry says nothing, silently smug behind the wheel. Garrett confessed what he told Henry, and Henry didn't waste any time sharpening it into a weapon to use against me. I occupy my mind thinking of all the painful moves I can inflict on Henry once we reach the bug out. Dislocate his other shoulder, snap his arm, kick out his kneecap. I know the moves, and am pretty confident I can execute them. All he has to do is give me a reason. Exposing my middle school creepitude to Alyssa should be reason enough, but that was really just my own karma coming back to bite me. As much as I want to, I can't make any sort of move against Henry until he proves himself to be the clear and present danger I suspect he is. But I can't act on a feeling, especially when Alyssa trusts him a whole lot more than she trusts me. It's been half an hour since we left Charity's little freeway commune. We cleaned up our camp at dawn, folded the linens, and returned them. It felt good folding the linens. It felt decent. Funny how that used to be my least favorite chore. We said goodbye to some of the friends we made during our brief stay, like Max, the handy biker. Then the water angel sent us off with more of those marshmallow sponge cakes, and then gave each of us hugs. Standing there in her embrace in a weird, childish way, I didn't want to let go. I know that Alyssa didn't want to leave. I was actually surprised that she didn't decide to stay, just to be rid of me. I mean, she would have gotten water there, or at least she would when she got dehydrated enough. Maybe she couldn't bear the thought of me getting to the bug out and getting water before she did. Or maybe she didn't want to part with Henry. Why bother breaking a limb? I could jam the heel of my hand into his nose and drive his nasal bone into his brain. We had to move the Aqua Viva box back to the bed of the truck to make room for all of us in the cab, which was hard to do without raising suspicion. There was a quiet discussion as to whether or not we should pull a couple of bottles from it to drink now. And this time, even I was willing to do it. But there was no way to open the box without revealing to Charity and her freeway folk that we had water. If they know about it, you know what'll happen, Jackie said. She'll claim it's community property, divvy it out to her minions, and there goes our emergency supply. I expected Alyssa to argue, because she's the only one of us altruistic enough to be okay with that. But she didn't. Maybe her anger at me has spread to the rest of the world. We agreed that we would pull over and open the box when we were far enough away. But now that we're moving, Henry flatly refuses to stop. We're almost there. Why stop now? We can all hold out for another hour, right? Yeah, we can wait, says Garrett, who suddenly became Henry's lapdog when no one was looking. And since no one wants to show less self-control than a 10-year-old, we all accept it. But if it's more than an hour, I'm kicking you in the head until you stop the car and let us get water, announces Jackie. I'd be happy if she started kicking him in the head right now, but I keep that to myself. I look through the car window. There's a haze that hangs in the air, thick and caustic. All of Southern California is blanketed in wildfire smoke. The dawn is angry crimson, and the sun, which has now risen enough to peer out from behind the mountains, is practically maroon, looking more like a blood moon than the sun. We haven't put music on the radio this morning. Instead, we switch back from satellite to the standard stations. Most stations are either offline or have triggered the emergency broadcast network, so it's the same thing almost everywhere. Mostly stuff we already know. Evac centers are at capacity, people are to go straight to overflow facilities, blah, blah, blah. We keep listening to the broadcast because I need to know about the fires. Three are burning far to the east, one completely blocking the road to Big Bear Lake. Two are burning in Castaic, more than 50 miles west of us, threatening access to Castaic Lake, which millions from Los Angeles are trying to reach. One report talks about relief coming to beaches again sometime today, but there's no way to know how successful this second wave will be. I imagine World War II and the Allied forces storming the beaches of Normandy, but with water instead of weapons. An operation like that would take months to organize. Whatever they're planning today, it's doomed to fall short of what's needed. If there's fresh water at the beach, maybe we should go there instead, Henry says, having no idea what the rest of us have already been through. Just drive, Alyssa says, not wanting to explain. We're only down in the aqueduct for half an hour before we emerge and follow a foothill road far enough from civilization to be beyond most roadblocks. Finally, we come to a sign that says, Now entering Angeles National Forest, with a red placard that says, Fire risk. High. Big duh. It looks like there actually had been a roadblock here. Cones and plastic barriers. But they've all been pushed aside and the site is unmanned. Apparently, the personnel were needed elsewhere. We keep driving, and the road begins to wind. It's not far now, I tell everyone. About 10 miles up. Look for a dirt road off to our left. Drive slow because it's easy to miss. I have a headache, announces Garrett, as if we all don't have headaches. It's from the smoke, Alyssa tells him, although it's probably more from the dehydration. I'm sure there's Advil at the bug out. There is, I tell her, but she doesn't even acknowledge that I spoke. She's disgusted to be in the same car with me. I guess I would be too. Of course, if it were the other way around, if she had a drone and looked in my window, I'd be flattered. Unless she was laughing. No, I guess I'd feel just as creeped out. I should probably just let her beat the crap out of me and get it over with, but I suppose in our current situation, crap beating is not a priority. And now I feel stupid for even worrying about it. As if my humiliation means anything in the big picture we're facing. And yet, in my moronic head, it does. Stupid. Is that the road we're looking for? Says Jackie about 15 minutes later. Yes, I say, although to be honest, I'm not 100% sure. But we'll know soon enough. Turn here. Henry veers off the paved road and onto the narrow dirt path. The truck barely fits between the trees, and the road is rugged. The truck suspension absorbs the worst of the bumps, but it can only do so much. My brain rattles against the walls of my skull. Garrett moans, telling Henry not to go so fast, but he's not going fast at all. What are we looking for? Henry asks. We'll go over a ridge, then back down into a valley, I tell him. Eventually, we'll come to a dry, rocky wash. Once we're there, turn right and follow the wash for about 3 clicks. Exactly what is a click? A kilometer. And then we'll see it? We won't see it, I tell him. That's the whole point of a bug out. 10 minutes later, we come to the wash, and I breathe a secret sigh of relief, because it means this was the right dirt road after all. Henry turns right, and we follow the rocky path, avoiding the boulders and ditches along the way. Finally, we come to an upturned tree stump with a red ribbon caught in its dead, gnarled roots. Only it's not caught. It's tied there. It's our marker. Stop, I tell Henry. We're here. We get out of the car and I lead everyone up the embankment of the wash and back into the forest. About 100 yards in, I stop. We're here, I tell everyone. We're where? Asks Jackie. I don't see anything but a whole lot of trees. Is it underground? Asks Garrett. Nope. Then I just stand there, waiting, wondering who will be the first to notice. Alyssa's the first. I was betting she would be. She gasps and points. There, she says. It's mirrored. She runs 12 yards ahead and the rest of us follow. As we get closer, the illusion weakens, but only because the glass has gotten dirty. Our bug out is a small A-frame structure. The mirrored side walls slope so that they reflect the higher reaches of trees, instead of reflecting people who might be approaching. It's an exceptionally successful camouflage. I suddenly love your seriously disturbed family, Jackie says. Just like at home, there's a hidden key. It's in a knothole in a tree, although it takes me a few minutes to find the right tree. Then, a couple of minutes more to poke around into the knothole, dislodging a spider and a bunch of other unpleasant critters that have taken up residence there. Finally, I reach in and pull out the key. I stride triumphant to the door, which is also mirrored, and slide the key into the deadbolt lock. Welcome, I say, to Castle McCracken.
Jackie.
How many lifetimes have I gone through since the riot at the beach? I'm used to life changing in the flicker of an instant, but the tap out has left every single moment a threat. How I live now is not the same as any of my yesterdays, and that void that always taunts me is now a moving target, making me lose all sense of direction. But right now, I don't care about any of that. All I care about is having a nice, long drink. Doesn't even have to be cold, it just has to be liquid. Our unlikely crew of accidental survivors now stands outside Kelton's family bug out, while Kelton makes a big production of opening the door. Welcome to Castle McCracken, Just let us in already, says Garrett. Finally, Kelton turns the key and pulls the door wide. Castle McCracken, my ass. The bug out has bugged out. The place is a mess. There are cans on the ground, clothes tossed everywhere, empty cereal boxes dumped on their sides. The place is small, but seems even smaller with all the junk spread around it. It's like a bear slipped in through the keyhole. This isn't right, says Kelton. We didn't leave it this way. When was the last time you were here? Henry asks, examining a spoon with peanut butter caked on it. Maybe a year ago, Kelton says, like it's a question rather than a response. It looks like I'm the only one with the courage to speak the obvious. There was a break-in. But Kelton shakes his head. There's no sign of that. The lock was intact, and it's not ransacked. Looks ransacked to me, says Garrett. Yeah, agrees Kelton, but not in the way a burglar would. Exploring deeper, Kelton pushes open a door to a bedroom. Two beds, one is made, the other disheveled. There are comic books on the floor. Kelton seems to reel out of his skin. No, he says. No, 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 no! He doubles back, pushing past the rest of us into the kitchen, pulling open cabinet doors. The cabinets are virtually bare. No, 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 no! He kneels, pulling open a trap door and drops inside. We can only watch his panic, not wanting to make it our own. He bumbles around down there. I can hear the ponging of jugs, and he hurls up a couple of them. When I look down, there are a whole bunch of plastic jugs down there. Empty. All empty. If it's not a break-in, then what the hell happened here? I ask. My brother happened here, he says, with so much anguish in his eyes I have to look away. This is where Brady must have been living. We knew he lost his job and bailed on his roommates. We thought he might be living with his girlfriend. It never occurred to us that he might come here, where he knew there was food and water enough to last for months. And I realize that was is the operative word here. Was is the difference between salvation and doom.
Alyssa.
This is not the end of the world, I tell myself. This is just a glitch. And now I'm grateful that Henry was so obstinate about not opening the box of Agua Viva. With all the forces that have been mobilized to bring relief, it will be a while until the supply chain can meet the demand, and the Agua Viva will get us through that time. There will be people, lots of people, who won't be able to hold out that long, but we won't be among them. Thanks to Henry. He wanted so badly to be the hero. Now he is. Kelton keeps digging through the storage space below, pulling out every plastic water jug, trying to get even the tiniest drops out. But all the jugs are open, and any moisture that had been left in them has long since dried up. I can't believe Brady did this, he wails. How could he do this? He knows better. Knew better, corrects Jackie, and I hit her hard enough to generate a warning glare, which I return with equal ferocity. Has she already forgotten how terrible Brady's death was, or is she so callous that she just doesn't care? Jackie turns to the pantry and starts pulling out styrofoam noodle cups. Well, at least we have plenty of chicken-flavored top ramen, she says. Just add hot water. Kelton groans. I turn to Henry, who has been unusually quiet through all of this. He offers me a slim, pained grin, and I try to offer him one back that's not quite so stretched. Some alkaline-infused goji berry mineral water sounds really good right about now, I tell him. It does, doesn't it? He says with a little chuckle. Kelton, give it up, says Jackie. The bug out's a bust. Back to the truck. Kelton is reluctant. He keeps digging through the same empty jugs, like he's going to find something different. Finally, he gives up. He climbs out of the crawl space and kicks the jugs in frustration. They make a sad noise, like muted church bells. When we leave, he doesn't even close the door, because what would be the point? We make our way down to the truck, which still waits for us by the upturned stump, and Jackie hops in the back, pushing things out of the way until she gets to the box. She hoists it and brings it out, setting it down. The corners are a little dented, but otherwise it's intact. She attacks the tape with her nails, but it's thick strapping tape, and there are multiple layers. "Does anyone have a Swiss Army knife?" She turns to Kelton. "How about you, Survival Boy?" "Yeah, there are plenty of knives back at the bug out," he says. "But none of us, least of all Jackie, wants to wait that long." "I'll go get one," Henry volunteers, but he's overruled. "Forget it," says Jackie, and holds out a hand to him. "Keys, please." Henry takes a step back from her as if there were a weapon in her empty hand, but Jackie's wriggling fingers are insistent. I'm pretty sure I know why he doesn't want to hand them over. Once Jackie has those keys, she's never giving them back to him. In the end, he relents and hands the keys over to Jackie. I wonder why he didn't just take over the task of opening the box himself. After all, it's his box. But the thought flits out of my mind before I even have time to really consider it. Jackie finds the sharpest key and starts slashing at the tape, then sawing it, then stabbing it. "Come on," says Garrett. "Hurry up!" Jackie grunts in frustration. What idiot tapes up a box like this? Finally, she gets a good-sized hole in the tape and starts working it larger until she can get her hand in and rip a whole flap off the top of the box. Then, with the box finally open, she just stands there. Instead of reaching in and pulling out water bottles, she just stares into the box. "Oh, you gotta be kidding," she says. "No freaking way." "What?" I say. "What is it?" Instead of answering, she dumps the box over and out spill hundreds of glossy brochures. "Agua Viva! Hydrate with elegance!" Pictures of slim, happy people jogging and a glistening mountain spring that makes my soul yearn to be in the picture. The sight of the pamphlets hits me like radiation. That is to say, I feel the sudden blast of this terrible truth. Yet I know the full ramification of it hasn't settled in yet. But it will. I think to the empty jugs in the bug-out, then flash to the people behind the football field fence, so desperate for water that they would sell their souls for a thimbleful. And then I flash to the rush Henry was in when he traded the box to get the truck keys back. How he wanted to get away as quickly as we could before that soldier opened the box. And I realize that this is not just a tragic mistake. Henry knew. He knew all along. Which is why I'm not entirely surprised when Garrett says, "Henry's gone."
33. Henry.
In life, one should always have an exit strategy for any given situation. I've always known this. Lived by it, even. But in this particular instance, I was caught woefully off guard. It never occurred to me that the bug-out would be a non-starter, because as much as I dislike Psycho Ginger, I believed he had our backs. Serves me right for letting my guard down. In a perfect world, no one would ever have opened that box. It would have been like Schrodinger's infamous cat. As long as the box stayed closed, there might actually have been water in there. At least as far as the others were concerned. And who's to say if their reality was any less real than mine? But when the box was opened, that all became moot. If I had my wits about me, I would have slipped out and taken off with the truck the moment I realized there was no water in the bug out. I should have abandoned any and all hope of being this ill-fated group's glorious savior, cut my losses, and bailed. But I hesitated. And that hesitation cost me everything. So now I'm left to stumble through the woods, no vehicle, thirsty beyond belief. I remember the way we came. I know how far it is back to civilization. if you could even call it civilization anymore. My plan is simple. I will make my way back to Charity and her freeway commune. I will make myself an indispensable part of her little collective, and I will receive enough water to survive. It will be a long, difficult trip. And although I have doubts as to whether or not I can make it, I have to try. It's all a matter of risk tolerance. And in this volatile world, what other choice do I have? But before I even get back to the road, I'm tackled to the ground. My first thought is that it's a bear, but then I realize it's much worse.
34. Kelton.
People trying to escape don't act in the smartest of ways. For example, Henry, not Roycroft. He took a direct path away from the truck, straight up the slope of the wash. But to get back to the road, he'd have to turn right once he reached the crest of the little ridge. So, just like in hunting a small-brained quadruped, I triangulated his course and ran the hypotenuse. I scrape my knuckles on a rock pretty badly as I'm taking him down, but the pain is a good kind of pain. It helps me to focus my anger where it belongs. Now, I've got him pinned with my knee on his xiphoid, making it hard for him to breathe, much less move. Quickly, I clamp my right thumb and forefinger around his windpipe. I've seen this in demonstration videos, so I know the theoreticals, but in practice it's different than I imagined. The windpipe doesn't stay put. It shifts and slides around. It takes a moment until I'm sure I have it. I know because I can hear him breathing. With all the air pushed out of him with my knee, it will only take about 10 seconds to render him unconscious.